All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2019-1482, State of Ohio versus Christopher L. Whitaker. For the appellant, Mr. Gamzo.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. Honorable Justices, may it please the court. Jeffrey Gamzo, along with my co-counsel, Erica Cunliffe, on behalf of Mr. Whitaker, and I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, please, for rebuttal. Christopher Whitaker was going to die in prison. That was a given. The question was...
So you can remove your mask.
I'm sorry?
You can remove your mask when you speak.
Sorry. Thank you. Christopher Whitaker was going to die in prison. There's no question about that. The question was the mechanics of that death. He might die of old age, natural causes, illness, or he might die by execution. But one way or another, he was going to die in prison. And he never disputed that. From the time that, after some dissembling, from the time that he accepted responsibility, in this case, when he was talking to the police, through voir dire, when his counsel said, we're not challenging the evidence against him. We accept. He accepts responsibility. He wanted, he told the police, to avoid a circus. He wanted, he told the police, to provide closure for the family. And that's what his counsel said from the beginning to the end. It's what Mr. Whitaker said during his unsworn statement to the jury at the end. And what he was trying to avoid, and to some extent, of course, obviously it's self-serving, but what he was trying to avoid was death by execution as opposed to death by natural causes, old age, illness, life without the possibility of parole, the other version of death in prison. And so, he asked before trial, he said, I will accept a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, of death in prison, no problem about that. I will accept that sentence, waive all post-trial proceedings, and we can, implicit in that, we can avoid the circus. We can provide, nobody has to sit there and see the pictures and hear the description of the horrible things that I did to this girl. We don't have to go through that if we can work this case out. We don't have to put the family through that. We don't have to put the friends through that. We don't have to put the public through that. And we don't have to put a jury and judges through that.
Counsel, did the victim's family ask for that?
I think the answer is probably yes, but I'm not sure as we speak.
Yes, they asked for an acceptance of life without parole negotiation?
He asked for it. What the victim's family wanted, I don't know.
You don't know what the family wanted. So his, your statement that he was not going to put the family through it, you don't know what the family wanted.
I do not know their position. But I know his, which is he didn't want to put them through it. He wanted to provide closure to them. And he asked, because the state turned that down, he said, I'd like to tell the jury in this case, not only the various forms of acceptance of responsibility that we've gone through, that counsel said from voir dire on to closing arguments, he said, I'd like to tell them that I made this offer. And the judge said, fine, you should be able to do that. And then this court's decision came out in Seoul. And the court said, nah, that's never admissible. Citing Dixon, citing Archie Dixon's case, where the court said, that's not admissible. This court has actually been of two, and the judge said, well, if the Supreme Court says in Saul it's not admissible, my hands are tied. No, you can't tell the jury that. 3 months to the day after Archie Dixon was decided by this court, and you said it's never admissible. 3 months to the day after that, in Timothy Hoffner's case, Archie Dixon's co-defendant, also sentenced to die, this court said, well, you know, his offer to plead turned down. It's mitigation. It's entitled to minimal weight. Minimal is the word that you used. But it's there. It can't be both. It can't be both entitled to some weight and never entitled to even be told to the jury. And the thing about this is that by turning down the offer, what this court has said, essentially, is that by the state's turning down the offer, the state has determined and effectively established that the offer itself can never be mitigating. That an irrebuttable presumption, that's what you've created, is an irrebuttable presumption that there can never have been even a smidgen of an acceptance of responsibility that one out of 12 jurors, because that's all that any juror might, not necessarily would, but might find meaningful, might choose to give some weight. Because each of the 12 jurors decides for him or herself and can say, this is worth 58,000 pounds, this is worth zero. Right? And all we're saying on this point is that this is something the jurors should be able to consider because it might mitigate for somebody. Yes, it has some self-serving effect, no question about that. I don't dispute that. But it is also some indication of an acceptance of responsibility.
Counsel, did his attorney present that to the jury about that the appropriate for their consideration, the appropriate recommendation would be life without parole?
Absolutely argued for
okay,
that.
Okay, so they understood that that's what the defense team, presumably, representing their client, that life without parole was something that they would accept.
Yes, and what I'm saying, this is another piece of evidence to support
so,
that.
So are you saying what this had to come from the mouth of Christopher Whitaker, not through his attorneys?
No, I'm saying that Christopher Whitaker's offer, the offer to plead to life without parole, as opposed to going through the trial, going through the trial requires, if you take away the death specifications, then you can do this in one, I'm pleading guilty, we've got an agreed sentence here, give me life without parole, it can be done in an afternoon. When he does not do that, because the state won't let him make that, won't accept that offer, when he does not do that, there is going to be a trial. No matter what happens, there is going to be a first phase where the jury and the family and the public is going to go through every horrible detail with photographs and descriptions of all the awful things. Mr. Whitaker, what he did is inexcusable. There's no dispute about that. Nobody's arguing that. Nobody argued it in court. But his offer, his accepting responsibility for it. I mean, it's what he said in his unsworn statement. He said, I've accepted full responsibility for my actions. I asked my lawyers, this is on page 3110 of the transcript, I asked my lawyers not to contest or challenge anything in this case because I really wanted the family to have closure. That was his offer. And that shows, that says something about his character. And 29, 2924B says that the defendants, that in mitigation, the jury shall consider the nature and circumstances of the offense, the history, character, and background of the defendant, and then all those things that are in B1 through 7. And this is, says something about his character. It's an extra piece of mitigation.
Counsel, you said you don't know what the family thought about that offer. However, if the family said to the state, to the prosecutor, I don't care that he's made that offer, I want you to move forward with seeking the death penalty, would that matter?
It might matter to the prosecutor, but it doesn't change what Mr. Whitaker wanted to do. What Mr. Whitaker was offering, it's his mitigation. It's not the, it's his mitigation that he's offering the family. Again, the jury can say this is worthless.
So it's mitigation for the sentencing phase.
Absolutely.
But the jury knew he made that offer.
No, the jury did not know he made that offer because when this court decided Soul before the trial, the judge said, well, I had told you before that that you could present this in mitigation as a mitigation fact. But after Soul was decided, which says it's never admissible, well, then it's not admissible. I can't tell them, or you can't tell them. So it didn't come in, not because he didn't want to tell them, but because it wouldn't be allowed, and it wouldn't be allowed because of what this court said in Soul. And I got to say, there's something else about Soul, which is that in Soul, Soul fought tooth and nail, unsuccessfully, obviously, but fought tooth and nail to get the jury to say he's not guilty. They fought tooth and nail in the first phase of that case. And in fact, I stood up here arguing Soul some years ago, and I said they shouldn't have done that. It would have been wiser, would have been better strategy for them to have accepted, to said, you know, we're not contesting this. You're going to find this guy guilty. But neither here nor there, they didn't do that. They didn't do it. Mr. Soul didn't do that. Mr. Whitaker did.
But Mr. Gamso. Over here, Mr. Gamso. Do we take into account how many times he changed his story and tried to evade responsibility until he was caught with DNA and finally had to change his approach?
I hadn't added up the number, but it runs on for some time while he's talking to the police, yes. But, you know, he did, in fact, after... There's something like, I think, 4.5 hours of his interrogation by the police. And somewhere along there, after an hour, hour and a half, something like that, he says, you know what? He starts backing away from his dissembling, which he's been doing, his various denials, and he says, I'm accepting responsibility. I am responsible for what happened to that girl. And so he comes out and does it. And then, from that point on, he stops disputing it. To the police, yes, he says in phone calls to his family, he says, well, no. But, you know, he's trying to protect his family and his image there. But with the police, with the jury, within the system itself, from the moment he accepts responsibility, from that moment on, he accepts responsibility for what he's done, tells everybody within the system that he's accepted responsibility for what he's done. That says something about his character. Maybe it doesn't say much about his character. Maybe, and once again, maybe 12 out of 12 jurors would say, that's worthless. We give that no weight whatsoever. But obviously they did not give enough weight to his acceptance of
responsibility. He wasn't precluded from presenting evidence that he accepted responsibility, though. He was just precluded from presenting evidence about the plea. Those are two different things. He could put all the evidence he wanted about accepting responsibility, right?
And he did. And he did, and he argued that, yes.
So what does the fact that I was willing to plead add to that? I mean...
Well, it adds to that. For one thing, with an explanation, it could say why we didn't have to go through this.
He could have testified to all that, though, right? He didn't take the stand, right? I'm trying to remember the case. Yes, he didn't take the stand. He gave an unsworn statement. He could have taken the stand, couldn't he?
He could have.
And he didn't.
That's correct.
If this was that important, why not take the stand?
I can't explain. And perhaps it was ineffective assistance of counsel that we didn't raise for why he didn't. But there are things he did, and there are other things that might have happened. But the fact that he made the offer and the underlying desire, which he did say, everything except the fact that he made the offer and that it would have prevented this whole thing from going on. That comes in, but that's an extra.
Would that give the defendant the right to kind of tell the state what they have to do? Because we always have pleas and settlements in an adversary system, and both sides agree, right?
Right.
But here, there was no agreement.
There was no agreement. And
that force, what you want us to say, wouldn't that force the state to take an agreement they don't want?
No. No. It would simply be, you know, here's something else for the jury to consider, that I made this offer. And when you first decided in Dixon that an offer to plead, and Archie Dixon, like Sowell, argued that, no, you shouldn't find me guilty. You know, I know you're probably going to, but you shouldn't. I mean, or to the jury, and Archie had confessed, and his confession, he actually confessed without Miranda warnings, and that was suppressed. And then a second confession after Miranda warnings, and that was admitted after appeals all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court on an interlocutory basis. But I mean, he fought, as Sowell did, not to be convicted, and not to be convicted of the crime. And in Dixon's case, what this court said was, and it's all of a paragraph long, really, addressing this. What the court said was, the trial court ruled correctly, not allowing Dixon to introduce his offer. In State versus Webb, we said that a prosecutor's offer to negotiate a guilty plea in a capital case is not mitigating, and such offer does not affect the appropriateness of the death penalty. Well, yeah, because the prosecutor's offer doesn't say anything about the character of the defendant. The defendant's offer says something about the character of the defendant. Maybe bad stuff. Maybe just a little bit.
Well,
it says something about the character of the defendant, and the statute says, and Lockett says, that the character of the defendant, the facts of the character of the defendant are mitigating.
But excuse me. What about the fact you said that once during the interrogation that he knew he was pretty much trapped, he's stuck with it, but I seem to recall from the record that he made phone calls from jail. And I understand that based upon his conduct from the jail, trying to get different witnesses to testify to different things, that he probably wouldn't want to take the stand. But go back to the irrebuttable presumption that's created when the state turns down the offer. So you're saying the irrebuttable presumption is that he did not accept responsibility. Is that what you're saying?
No, the irrebuttable presumption is that the offer can only be a self-serving desire. It can have had no purpose other than to say, I'm trying to save my life. And that's what this court has established as that irrebuttable presumption. And I mean, it says it. A defendant's offer, I'm quoting from State versus Sowell here, paragraph 130, a defendant's offer to plead guilty, never accepted by the prosecutor, is not relevant to the issue of whether the defendant should be sentenced to death. In Dixon, on paragraph 69, Such an offer does not affect the appropriateness of the death penalty. We conclude that it's not relevant. And what you've said is the offer can't be relevant. And what I'm saying is, yes, it can. Maybe not in every case. Maybe it's not. Maybe. I don't actually.
Well, when you say, Counselor, over here, when you say maybe not in every case.
I'm willing to say, I think Sowell and Dixon are flat out wrong. I think it's admissible across the board. But even if they are right in those cases, if they're right in those cases where counsel is struggling, where the defense is struggling to achieve a not guilty verdict, where the defense accepts responsibility throughout the trial, it is another piece of evidence of acceptance of that responsibility. And if that's the case, then...
But why wouldn't it be relevant in cases like Sowell or Dixon?
I think it is relevant in those cases.
Well, what case would it not be relevant?
I think it's relevant across the board because it indicates...
But that's not what you said.
No, it is what I'm saying. I think it is relevant across the board in all cases because it indicates something about the defendant's character.
I thought you just said a few minutes ago, in some cases, it might not be relevant.
The jury might say, we don't think this tells us anything.
Well,
the
jury doesn't decide relevancy. The court does.
The jury may decide this has no weight whatsoever.
Weight. But the court decides relevancy.
And by deciding that it's irrelevant across the board, what this court has said is it cannot have any weight, and it can't because this court cited the Sixth Circuit, Owens v. Guida, and in Guida says, you know, and it was a habeas case, so the standards are different and the measure is different, but Guida keeps out that information from it also, and she had argued that. That this was of some value, of some mitigatory value. And the Sixth Circuit said the defendant in that case said, you know, it would have accepted responsibility, her punishment would have been in the hands of the jury, just as it ultimately was in her having made the offer and it having been turned down. She was less interested in accepting responsibility and more interested in avoiding the electric chair, a motivation that is much less persuasive as a mitigating factor. Well, less persuasive is not the same thing as not persuasive.
Counsel, let me ask you this. You say it's relevant to his character. Wouldn't it have been more relevant to his character if he didn't want something in exchange for that, if he was willing to live with the...
It might not have been more relevant to his character. It would have said something more about something more positive about his character.
But the jury in this case knew that that's what he wanted in exchange for that.
Well, they didn't know that he was offering the exchange. They didn't know what the exchange would have achieved. And that's some evidence. Look, it may be that weighing I'm offering to save all this and prevent all this circus from going on, and yes, it adverts to my benefit also.
But ultimately,
okay. Maybe that undercuts the force of...
The state, it's ultimately the state's decision to decide whether a set of facts rises to the level where it shocks the conscience of society that it's the worst of the worst. So he doesn't have any control of that, and neither does the family's wishes at all, right? I mean, it's the state's
decision. The state does not technically represent the family, absolutely. The state represents the state of Ohio, the people of Cuyahoga County in this case. State is not the family's lawyer. And although we know, and understandably, the prosecutors listen to the desires of the family, at least some, and adhere to them at least some of the time, the state doesn't represent them. But what we're saying, really, is this indicates something. It indicates something about his character.
Counsel, couldn't it also be viewed, as I'm looking at it right now, he wants to put the state in the bad light. I would be willing to go with life without parole and save this circus, as his words are. But the state won't give me life without parole, so we have to go through this circus, and it's all the state's fault.
Well, once again, the prosecutor told the jury, one of the prosecutors told the jury, and I do not have the page reference handy, but he said, we're not happy about going through all this, but we have to do it. We are required to show you every jot and tittle and every detail and every photograph that shows just how awful what Mr. Whitaker did is.
Notwithstanding how much the quantity of evidence, but wouldn't that be true if the state decided, no, we're not going to accept that offer, we're seeking the death penalty, and so we have to show everything that's required of the state to show in order to ask for the death penalty. We need to show those aggravating factors.
Well, and they said that. They said, he said, one of the prosecutors, once again, and
But wouldn't that be true if they decided to seek the death penalty?
It's not. Of course it's true. Okay. Well, it's true that they had to present the evidence. Did they have to present it with the detail that they did with every specific stuff, but putting that aside.
I was saying the quantity, correct.
But putting that aside, yes, they had to present, because the case went to trial, they had to present evidence of the death of the aggravated murder, and they had to present evidence of each of the specifications that
they
drawn.
You have less than 5 minutes left.
Now, I'd like to reserve that time, if I might. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mullen?
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices. My name is Catherine Mullen. On behalf of the State of Ohio, appellee in this case, we are asking this court to affirm the defendant's convictions and sentence of death. One of the things that was just repeatedly said to you by my friend on the other side is that there was no alternative, that he had to go to trial, because otherwise he would have pled and agreed to a death sentence. That's not correct. As this court knows recently from the George Brinkman case, he could have entered a guilty plea to a 3-judge panel without agreeing to a death sentence and had his fate decided by that 3-judge panel. That's not uncommon. It was another alternative, and it would have prevented the circus that Whitaker likes to talk about. But in reality, the only circus that Whitaker wanted to prevent was his own.
But even if that were the case, Ms. Mullen, why wouldn't that information, the fact that he offered to plead guilty and get a life sentence, why isn't that information that the fact finder, in this case the jury, should have when deciding on the sentence?
I don't believe it's relevant. I think this court got it right in Dixon, and I think this court got it right in Soul. I don't see how his unaccepted offer to plead guilty has any relevance to his character, background, or any mitigating factor whatsoever.
But a jury, isn't it plausible that a juror might think so?
I suppose it's possible. I think anything's possible, Your Honor. But I think in terms of relevancy, as you noted, Justice, the court is the gatekeeper of relevancy. I think as it goes to relevancy, it's not there.
Well, counsel, if you just conceded that maybe some juror might think that that's, relevant and could assign some level of weight to it, by the same token, the state counters that with, yes, he's pleading guilty, ladies and gentlemen, but, here's what he wanted, and here's the nature of the crime and the heinousness of what he did, et cetera, and the state did not accept. I mean, those are all facts. Why, that could have been. Now, I'm not saying that Sowell was wrong or Dixon. I'm just asking this question.
I agree, Your Honor. I think it could have been. I think if it had been a matter that came up at trial, we would have thoroughly done everything we could to effectively rebut that suggestion. And I would direct this court to the trial court's sentencing opinion, where the trial court, in her sentencing opinion, does actually twice reference the fact that the defendant did offer to plead guilty. And I believe in the sentencing opinion, the trial court, I just want to use the correct terminology, I believe that she said it was entitled to little weight.
Do you think that the trial court was justified in finding it irrelevant based on the number of times he wouldn't admit, and then even after he did admit, then he tried to recant and dissemble, as your colleague put it, even from jail? I mean, and does the court have the right to sort of weigh that evidence so that it can find that it's irrelevant?
Well, and I don't know, Justice Bruner, I don't know that that's necessarily the weighing decision the court did when deciding admissibility. I think that the court was more guided on this court's precedent, and I think that the offer to plea, an unaccepted offer to plea, as this court mentioned, and I understand Webb is a different factual context, but again, I don't think it goes to the character of the defendant. I think the overall character of the defendant, which would be the fact that he did allegedly accept some responsibility or allegedly showed remorse, those are facts that came out during the entire duration of both phases of
the trial. Excuse me, though, but couldn't a juror just as easily, after hearing that, think that he had no character because it took that long for him to come to the realization that this was in his best interest?
For the offer to plea?
Certainly. Couldn't a juror look at that information that was kept from the jury and have determined that he actually had no character?
I don't know about that. I think that the jury heard a lot of evidence about character, and he obviously, defense counsel tried to paint it in the light of him taking responsibility. They were arguing almost immediately by helping the police locate evidence and think. So I don't know that they would have been able to decide that his delay in a plea offer ultimately meant that he had no character. I think that that's something that we certainly could have argued to show why it wouldn't have supported that. But I think that there was, he did try, that was the basis mostly of his mitigation, was that he tried to show that he was remorseful. And so I think that they would have gotten there anyway.
Counselor, from a holistic standpoint, one of my concerns is if we say and we stick to the premise that this information is not relevant and therefore can't be submitted to the jury, then a defendant could say, okay, then, similar to Dixon and Sowell, I won't plead guilty. I will make the state try this case. I will drag this out. I will make you pay $1 million to defend me because I'm indigent. And so from a holistic standpoint, it seems that our saying that that information isn't relevant, that that small piece of information, which may or may not have any impact on the jury, is irrelevant when it could be used to unnecessarily drag this out at the expense of the family, at the expense of the state, at the expense of the lawyers, just everyone.
I think that goes to one of Mr. Whitaker's other propositions of law, which is the idea that his claim is that it's unconstitutional, that he can't enter a plea and then preserve a jury for the sentencing phase. Which is, of course, not statutorily condoned in Ohio, nor is it by precedent. But I don't know. You know, the answer, Justice O'Connor, is that I don't know. I don't
that's
know whether
O'Connor. I'm Stewart.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
We look alike, I know.
And you know,
resemblance is striking.
As long as I've known you from the 8th District, I should have gotten that right. But I apologize. But no, I think that I don't know. I don't know whether he would have dragged that out. I don't know whether other defendants would have dragged that out. You know, they obviously it's up to them. It's completely up
sure,
to them.
Sure, it is, and it's obviously a horrific, you know, decision, but, you know, people commit these crimes, obviously don't care much about much of anything. So I'm just trying to, you know, extrapolate, you know, long term what the effects of. I mean, relevancy is relevancy. Relevant is relevant, and the court determines that. But if we've got conflicting, as Mr. Gamso seems to note, that in some instances we say it has minimal relevancy, in some instances we say it has no relevancy, then how do we reconcile that?
Well, I guess even if Your Honor has decided to clarify that on the side of saying that it would be relevant, that it was something that the defense could bring up if they chose, it would have no practical impact on this case whatsoever because, again, the trial court did consider it in her findings. But also, it has no impact on this case because it was just, it was a fact in addition to the acceptance of responsibility that he tried to paint throughout the entire trial. So it would have done no more, is the state's position, it would have done no more than do what he already did throughout the entire duration of both phases of the trial.
But the jury didn't have the unsworn statement, so it only had the statement of counsel, presumably in closing, that the offer had been made but not accepted. But isn't the jury typically instructed that the arguments of counsel are not evidence?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe, as Justice Fisher pointed out, he could have testified if he wanted to. He chose not to, and I assume it's because he would have been subject to significant cross-examination. So to the fact that to the acceptance of responsibility came out, that was painted primarily by counsel and during the unsworn statement, and then we attempted to rebut it with the jail calls and the video of his confession to the police, where he, it was very clear from those videos that he did not immediately accept responsibility and only provided information based on the facts that he was receiving from law enforcement.
But should the state control by its refusal of a plea and the operation of Sowell and Dixon what evidence the jury hears? Because essentially, in that case, the state really does affect the outcome.
Well, I think ultimately, though, that's a decision for the trial court, not so much the state. I mean, if it had been an accepted plea.
But you just said that you thought that the court wasn't weighing the evidence, then that the court was applying Sowell and Dixon, and that's how it reached its decision on relevancy.
Right.
So that's, it does, in effect, put the state in the driver's seat, doesn't it?
I think we're in the driver's seat always in terms of whether or not we accept a plea.
No, on admissibility of evidence.
I don't think that we're in the driver's seat on admissibility of evidence, at least with respect to the court's always the gatekeeper there, but especially with respect to this issue, if the court had determined, contrary to Sowell and Dixon, that it was going to allow evidence of an unaccepted plea offer, that we would have been stuck with that decision. But the fact that, if in terms of the control we had, the only control that we had was whether or not to accept his offer, which we did not do. But we didn't control whether or not the court decided what the jury could hear.
And the reasoning being that you didn't accept it was because of the need to prove the aggravating circumstances, correct?
We didn't accept the plea offer, and this would go to evidence outside the record, Your Honor, but we didn't accept the plea offer, one, because the victim's family was wholly adamant and in support of the death penalty in this case. And also, I think the facts of this case, the death penalty is the only appropriate sentence here. So that's why the plea was not accepted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to turn, Your Honors, to Proposition 1, which is the victim impact argument. And I wanted to direct this court's attention to a couple of different areas in the transcript. The state did attempt to limit the photographs that the jury was exposed to, and we did that at multiple times during the trial. But I would like to direct this court's attention to transcript pages 549 through 550, where there was a discussion on the record that we had printed out our photographs and wanted to schedule a meeting with the defense attorneys to go through them to discuss admissibility in advance. Page 1965, we talk about how we removed photographs after meeting with the defense, and then we additionally removed more photographs. On page 2164.
Why did the state need this cast of characters board? I mean, what was the point of that?
We'd like to do it to show the jurors who they're dealing with. So most of the time, the pictures that we use are license photographs from Ohio license driver's licenses.
But why do the jurors need that? I mean, are you just trying to remind them of all the damage that this guy did to these people's families? And
no, it's just a guide. It's just a guide to keep the witnesses straight. There's a lot of witnesses, particularly in these cases, there's a lot of witnesses. And I think for the lay witnesses, it's good to show who they are, to have that familiarity. That issue did come up at trial, and we did agree to take down the board. So we would have the witness go up and, we would go up and put a picture on the board, and then we would take the board down. So the board was not left down or left up in between the different witnesses. It was only used for that brief period of time where we would put up their picture. But I think it's just kind of a.
What about pictures of the family and showing relationship and I mean you know wasn't that improper victim impact?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, we had one picture of the victim, which is Exhibit 200, and then we had one picture of her mother, which is Exhibit 201, and then we had one picture for each of the other lay witnesses. So it certainly wasn't overly emotional. It was just one snapshot. And I believe in my brief, I directed this court to its opinion in State versus Myers, where there was photographs of the victim, I believe with her child. And that was, there was a discussion in that opinion that was one of the only photographs that was available to the state. Unfortunately, we had few photographs available to us as well. So we used one picture for each witness. And like I said, most of those were would have been some kind of state ID or driver's license picture. This court has also, I believe it was cited in this court's decision in Graham, but this court in the Hartman decision also considered something similar, which was the minimal testimony about the victim's early childhood, the victim's education. And we did have some of that here, understandably. But that was used here because the victim was abducted on her way to school. So where she went to school, the schedule of her school, what time she usually got home, the fact that her mother had a meeting at 5 p.m. about her intensive education plan, those were relevant not just as pure victim impact, but those were relevant to show why phone calls were made when the victim didn't return home. They were also.
I would hope that any parent would make phone calls when his or her child didn't return home at a certain time.
I would hope so too, Your Honor, but that's not been my experience.
Okay, well, and granted, I'll say that, but the fact that this mother did wasn't remarkable.
It wasn't remarkable, but it is what got the ball moving with the search that was conducted both by the school and the police.
But how is any of that relevant when he's admitted to the crime?
Because even though he's admitted to the crime, it was still a trial. We still had to prove our case. We still had to prove our case beyond a reasonable doubt.
You had to prove that he committed the acts he was charged with.
Correct, Your Honor.
So how is the fact that she did not show up from home and her mother made calls relevant to his committing the crime?
That's relevant to show that the victim was kidnapped. It's relevant to show that the victim was missing. Ultimately, it's relevant to show that she never came home. The testimony about the fact that she went to school also included what her normal uniform was like that day. And those were some of the items that were found and collected as evidence in the house. So again, they tie back to each other. So this is not the situation that this court was found erroneous in Graham, where you had pages and pages and pages about how the victim liked to keep fish or you know, the impact that it had on the family or anything like that. This was very limited and narrow in scope. And just like we limited and narrowed the testimony in this case, we attempted to do as much as we could with the pictures as well. And then that evidence was again narrowed before the second phase of the trial. We were mindful, you know, we are mindful of this court's precedent about gruesome photographs. And the photographs that we used in this case were not duplicative. They were not repetitive. They showed either different angles or close-up things. But that's because there was a tremendous amount of blood splatter and evidence in this case. It was just the nature of what happened here. I'd like to turn to proposition number two, which is the sufficiency claim for aggravated burglary. The appellant made two arguments in his brief. One was that the home was not an occupied structure, and the other was that the victim could not be the other person present for the purpose of aggravated burglary. I think that this court's recent precedent from last year is very supportive of the fact that the home, although under a significant remodel and torn up, and the homeowner, I believe, testified he hadn't been there since the summer, you still look at the purpose of the location, and it remained, to use this court's terminology, it remained a structure capable of being occupied. So I think we're fine on the occupied structure element.
I mean, the statute says it includes a structure that's temporarily unoccupied. How long? I mean, what's temporary mean? This seems at some point it's more than temporarily unoccupied, right?
Right. It was certainly a period of months. I put other cases in my brief, Your Honor, that where the same thing had happened, that it had been periods of months in other cases, and I would ask this court to adopt that. The homeowner testified that he never gave Mr. Whitaker permission to be in the house, that he had intention of rehabbing the house, that he took steps to lock up the premises so that people could not get in there.
How many months was it in this case?
I believe he said the victim went missing January 26th, which is 2017, which is what we believe the homicide date was. And the homeowner had testified that he was last there sometime, I believe, in the summer.
He was last there doing renovations, right? When's the last time someone occupied the structure?
From my understanding, that would have been the homeowner's father, but I couldn't tell you exactly when that was.
So years?
It might have been years, because he bought the premises from his father, I believe. So it was certainly a period of time.
Counsel, was the structure visibly boarded up?
Some of it was, yes, Your Honor. Yeah. And he did make, they at one point they had like a dog in the backyard that I believe they got in trouble for. But he did try to make attempts for people not to get in, but he testified that he was working, that he worked at a factory in Solon, and he wasn't there. But I do think that's consistent with some of the precedent that I've cited from other courts throughout the state.
The property was not abandoned.
No, it was not abandoned.
He did intend when he had the money, had the means, whatever, to rehab and use this for some kind of maybe halfway house or, you know, that's what his testimony was.
Yes, Your Honor, he intended to use it as a halfway house once he renovated it. To the second element that the defense or that the appellant challenges, I'm not aware of any precedent that says that the victim in this case, although forcibly transported to the home, cannot be the other person present to satisfy that element of aggravated burglary. The defense does not cite any case for that position. I, in my research, could not find any that that would support that understanding. And I would note that if this court looks at the elements of aggravated burglary itself, when you look at the other person present language, the legislature specifically removed anybody who was an accomplice as part of that equation. I suppose they also could have added, if they had wanted to, anybody that was not affiliated with the home or anybody that was forcibly transported to the home. That language doesn't appear in the statute. So what Mr. Whitaker is asking you to do is essentially add that.
Do we need to do that analysis, though, to find the burglary, the aggravated burglary, to consider whether the other person, the victim, can qualify as the other person?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed part of that.
Do we need to do that that analysis? Do we need to determine whether the victim being the other person satisfies the definition?
Well, I think that's one of the, that's one of the challenges that they're making now. The defense did make a Rule 29 motion at trial, although it was not specified. It was just sort of perfunctory.
Right, but I guess, do we need to do the victim being present as an analysis in order to find that it was an occupied structure under the statute?
No, I think those are two different questions. I think there's a question of whether or not there's an occupied structure, and then the second part of it is whether or not there was a person present.
Okay.
And for the same reasons, Your Honor, Mr. Whitaker raised essentially the same argument for the manifest weight, and for the same reasons, we would ask that that be denied. I'd like to turn briefly to the sufficiency challenge to abuse of a corpse. There is no requirement that he commit any type of affirmative act or physical abuse on a corpse in order to be convicted of abuse of a corpse. That being said, what the evidence showed at trial was that the victim was terrorized and tortured and essentially mutilated in one room. And then the photographs will show you that she was dragged from that room into a side bedroom. The evidence also shows that there was a blood stain in the wall, in the closet, and it appeared that there had been some type of an attempt to put her in the closet based on that stain and the angle of the victim where she was located ultimately on the floor. That would be an affirmative act of concealment.
But doesn't our case law essentially say, or case law, if you move a corpse, that's abuse?
It does.
Let alone everything you just described.
Exactly, Your Honor, I agree. And I know one of the examples that I cited for this court is State versus Warfel. And in that case, it was the victim's child actually died, and he left the child in her crib for 6 weeks. So there wasn't, that child was just left there until she was accidentally found by a cable installer. Here we have even more of an affirmative act.
So essentially anything that you do or don't do to a corpse can be abuse of a corpse.
Well, it still has to shock, I believe the statutory language is that it still has to shock the general conscience or something to that language. But I think what was done here with trying to shove her into a closet it certainly satisfies that. There were a couple other examples that I cited, like State versus Condon, where the defendant in that case was taking pictures and manipulating bodies in the morgue just for his own gratification. And that, again, is, of course, something that shocks the consciousness. But I think it's consistent with this court's precedent and precedent from the lower courts. To affirm that count. And I did briefly, I see I'm getting shorter on time, I did want to turn to Proposition 4, which is the argument that the kidnapping was double weighted. There were two counts of kidnapping. One of the counts of kidnapping included the terrorizing and the physical harm. The other count of kidnapping was the sexual assault kidnapping. The jury found Mr. Whitaker guilty of both of those. And Mr. Whitaker makes the argument that they somehow double-weighted the kidnapping because there had been two kidnapping counts. I've cited State versus Roe for this court, which I think does a really nice analysis on that issue. I surprisingly did not find much precedent on this issue. But I do think that the term kidnapping, as it is found in the aggravating circumstances, is broad and encompassing. And it would cover both of the statutorily defined kidnapping counts that he was convicted of. So it wasn't double-weighted. It's how the language of the statute read. He was indicted with kidnapping using the language of the revised code, which this court has upheld and said is fine. And then kidnapping encompasses the acts that he did here, which was the terrorizing, the serious physical harm, and the sexual, and ultimately the sexual assault of the victim. And finally, Your Honors, I'd like to turn to the to this court's independent weighing. Mr. Whitaker didn't present much mitigation. He really didn't have much. He talked about, he was in his 40s when he committed this offense. He had prior offenses, as this court's aware. He was ultimately diagnosed with cocaine, a cocaine abuse disorder. He talked about smoking marijuana. This court has generally not considered that to be a strong mitigating factor. There's also no evidence that he actually did ingest cocaine at the time of this offense. He tried to claim responsibility and admit responsibility and to some extent, but then if you look at his statements, if you listen to his jail calls, he makes denials. He makes a lot of denials. And this court has previously said that those denials negate the mitigating weight that this court might otherwise give an acceptance of responsibility.
Are you saying that possibly even if we took another look at Sowell and Dixon, that it wouldn't affect the outcome because there would be other factors that would still go to the need to impose the ultimate sentence?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. I think the trial court in its sentencing opinion put it best, and to paraphrase her words, this was not a close call. This was not a close call given the aggravating circumstances and what he presented in mitigation. The trial court did give his upbringing, the loss of the very young loss of his mother, his sister's medical condition, all of this. The court said in her opinion that she gave it significant weight. And I don't disagree with that, but it still pales in comparison to the aggravating circumstances of this case. And pending any further questions, the state's prepared to rest, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gamzo, you have about 4 minutes left.
Very quickly, the judge in her sentence, the fact that the judge in her sentencing opinion discusses, mentions the plea offer is an indication that somebody thinks it has mitigatory relevance. Mitigatory value. Perhaps very minimal, but there's some there. All we're saying on that point is, yes, one of the jurors, maybe all of the jurors, could have found some value in that, and therefore, it is admissible. It does indicate good things, bad things, something about his character that he made that offer. And it's consistent with, unlike the cases of Sowell and Dixon, it is consistent with the defense that he didn't present, essentially, which is he accepts responsibility for this. We're not disputing any of that. We submit that's relevant. And in regard to what my friend has just said about the first proposition of law, there is a whole lot that the state presented there that is flat out irrelevant. I mean, yes, mom made calls. Yes, they had to prove that she was kidnapped, that the girl was kidnapped. Yes, no question. They did not have to give us blow-by-blow descriptions of 3 days of the search for her body, of how the school principals were out there and people were sticking up signs and canvassing the area. No, that's not relevant to the question. That is there only to say, look what these folks went through. And what these folks went through is not relevant to the question of what he did. What the family, the friends, the community, the FBI was involved. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for the question of whether the girl was kidnapped. It doesn't matter for any of the counts or specifications in this case. It matters only to inflame the passions and prejudices of the jury. And yes, they did it during the culpability phase, but that spills over. That was the intent. And they're not supposed to do that. They're not supposed to be presenting irrelevant evidence that has no positive effect except to prejudice the jury.
Isn't it probative of the time, or right over here, the time of death that you want to show? She was kidnapped at the time?
Well, she's kidnapped on one day. She's found 3 days later. She disappeared on day one. She is discovered 3.5 days later, roughly. Yeah.
So it's relevant to the time of.
And the coroner, the coroner is able to testify. They're able to show when this was done to her, and how they searched, how everybody searched. That has nothing to do with that. That doesn't show anything about when she was, in fact, damaged, in fact, tortured, kidnapped, raped, murdered. In regard to the aggravated burglary, the house had been empty for some 6 months. It was early in the summer that the owner was last there, and he was in the process. His intent down the road was to rehabilitate the house, to rehabilitate this building, or renovate this building, rehabilitate it, and use it as a group home, maybe, down the road. But he hadn't been there for 6 months. The only thing he'd been in the process of doing, as he testified, state said, so you were in the process of gutting the building? And he said, yes. That's what I was doing. I was gutting it. He'd bought it from his father. His father had bought it several years earlier and not used it for anything. This place had not been fit for habitation, had not been used as a habitation, not for a winter, not for a couple of months, but for years.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you. We'd ask you to reverse.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marcia, we'll call a short recess.